Okay, I'll start with these two. In addition to the images I've used so far for us to get a sense, you know, like the Klein model of where there's no in and no out, I'm sure you will recognize the author of this, or the article.
Escher.
And in the little diagram on it, I have a whole book of Escher. He is just so much fun. He has a lot of these kind of ones, and people can look through the book on Escher. He's that's a self-portrait. He has a lot of these where he quotes evolution, you know, and they're from little wormy, squirmy things until they become sort of more recognizable things. This is what he says on this particular one, because all of his are really to, in some way, confront the dualistic mind. He says here, he provides us with the ultimate three-tiered visual conceit. We are shown a drawing of a hand, drawing a hand, drawing a hand, drawing a hand. Okay? This image gave a platform here for teasing us around the two and three dimensions. See, we think two dimensions is here and three dimensions is over here. And so he, you know, the task would be, where did it leave three dimensions and become two dimensions on this drawing? You can hardly find the moment it transfers one to the other. But folks, most things out there are neither two dimension or three dimension. You know, in fact, this is most likely, that kind of idea is most likely one of the springboards for understanding what's called TOE. Anybody know what TOE stands for? Theory of everything. And that's what the scientists are looking for now, a theory of everything. This quote would be perfect now. Because, you see, at the time of the Enlightenment, when everybody was excited that we had now learned everything, because we had Newton, you know? Alexander Pope was caught up in it. And it's nature and nature's laws lay hid in the night until God said, let Newton be. And all was light. Now, you all know that Newton, you know, he is profoundly important. We wouldn't be able to do most things of mechanical physics, thermodynamic physics, use the health supply. He told us how the planets go around and all that. But the thing about Newton, as well as Pythagoras way earlier, is they avoided anything that was messy. You know? So they did a lot of things about cones and things that you could call nice. And it's amazing, if you only deal with what's nice, you can measure it, you can predict it, you can do all things in the most wondrous way. You know, so people have been brought to their knees. There is a God, you know, because there is a law that tells me how I can, you know, if one train leaves New York at 40 miles an hour, another one leaves Boston at 60, when will they meet? We can solve that problem very easily using that kind of thought. But what if we wanted to get the volume of a cloud? Now, clouds are notoriously messy, you know? And that's how most of the world is. We need another whole branch of mathematics, which is totally thrilling, and you'll be thrilled to know I won't go into it. It's called chaos theory. And in chaos theory, one of the little pieces of it is they have dimensions, like something could be 2.7 dimension, somewhere between two-dimensional and three-dimensional. You know, it's... And this guy, anticipated fractal geometry, which is a sub-part of chaos theory, by maybe 100 years. He he was doing early 20th century, he was doing this, that is trying to get us to break down a sort of separation between one dimension, two dimension, three dimension. And then just to give you a teaser, out here at UCSB, one of the, you know, the theoretical physics department out here, there's a guy there who is one of many in the United States that talk about string theory as a possible candidate for the theory of everything. And, you know, I read it and I read it and I read it and I get a few little images. But my current image of it is that the planet, everything here, everything, because it's a theory of everything, is like Velcro. You know, not the fuzzy side of Velcro, but the gnarly side of Velcro. And it's like, oh dear, Stephen Hawking talks about that there has to be either 9 or 10 dimensions to make the mathematics work. Okay? And so where are the other dimensions? With Einstein, we only have 4 dimensions. The 3 dimensions of space and 1 dimension of time. Well, string theory is looking at the idea that all these other dimensions are embedded in stuff that's gnarly. And I tell you, this idea has given me just incredible, I don't know what the word is, not hope.
Nightmares.
No, because I don't have to solve it. And that is that there's life after death. You know, because I also read people like Richard Dawkins and all of those fundamental atheists, you know, who are ultimate dualists, because for them materiality is the upper and spirituality is fog.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't even, you know, they're almost monist. They are so much on the level of matter over mind. Okay, so I mean, if we do have this this incredible universe or series of universes, and all of this is possible, you know, right here, somewhere in a little gnarly thing, could be my good mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here with me today, saying, "Go for it, girl. I never got to." Yeah. There's room for that kind of thing and being compatible with the search for the theory of everything. Okay. Now, what are some other images of? Okay. One other image I will do, and then I will leave room just for. All the time we have had to go through dualism from, say, Aristotle up until the late part of the 19th century and then the 20th century, where physics totally exploded the notion of dualism. In Einstein's E equals mc squared, I mean, that blows the mind. E, energy, non-material, akin to spirit, to matter, to mind, is a different form of matter in math. I mean, this is the most profound equation for saying non-dualism just doesn't go far enough. Dualism just doesn't go far enough. And then, you know, a few years later, they started to do work on quantum physics, and again we get it, but I won't go into that. This symbol, which you know is yin-yang symbol, all of these years, going back 3,000 years, the Asian tradition has been non-dualistic in the most amazing way, the most amazing way. And I had some more things I'd say, but I'm not going to. What I want to do first is to open it to observations or questions, and then if any of the stuff I haven't looked at would explain any answer, I'll pull it out. So, what are things you want to say? Yeah.
You're amazing.
I know a lot of things. It's a lot harder to be them. As I said, when I get in an argument, I forget all about dualism. I mean, not dualism. I want to be right, and I want to be powerful, and I want you to. So it's a lot harder to be that which, you know, whatever. Mary.
Don, you said that you would share some of your practices.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
I just wanted to ask if you could do that before we get to
the Okay. Yeah, I could do some of that. First of all, I don't think I've ever had a top-notch mystical experience. The community I was in for 20 years, here's the line, were called contemplative, active nuns. We had 6 hours of prayer a day.
Oh, wow.
We had as much prayer as the Carmelites did. But we didn't get up in the middle of the night to do matins, you know? We had the divine office. And our prayer, we were given incredible support in prayer. And I think early on, the closest thing I had, and it's more pervasive for my life, is that I can get to a place in which the chit-chat in my head stops. And I remember I was a novice, and the first time I commented on this, and the Mother Superior asked me what I do in prayer, you know? 6 hours of it. It was an hour and a half of mental prayer. And then there was mass, etc., recitation of the divine office. And I said, well, I get to these places in which I just stop thinking. And I feel as though my heart and God are talking. And that I get a sense of what it's all about. But I really don't know the details. Mm-hmm. I just leave with a sense of fullness. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when I read that passage in the Old Testament about, I can't remember which guy it was, Jeremiah. Yeah, it was one of the E's, I think, Elisha. Slept under the tree and woke up and he ate the food that he was told to take and eat, and he walked in that for 40 days. That's how I feel, you know, just that. And that place comes to me with some frequency. I have read a lot of the mystics. Back to my early years at Olcott de Maria, I ticked off all of them, you know, Teresa and John of the Cross and MacPeel, and especially Hildegard of Bingen. And I think I liked Hildegard so much because she had her fingers in every, you know, she was a mystic in the most classical sense. But she also was an herbologist, and, you know, knowledge was not something she despised. So she was really a non-dualist. But other isn't this something I have to look at my notes to see what else I do. Early on at La Casa, I became aware of a practice called focusing by Ed McMahon and Pete Campbell, two former Jesuit priests. Priest still, but, you know, priest without a diocese, without a bishop. You know, we know about priests like that, right? And they call it biospirituality. So I absolutely object to saying of people who say don't believe in, say, religion, but I'm spiritual. Actually, I hope not. I hope you're biospiritual. Because you cannot leave the body behind without being dualistic. And they talk about this. So I won't go into all of focusing, but it's been maybe the most important thing, and the thing that's a practice for me regularly is to be in that focusing way in which you look at with empathy anything. So I look at my crazy mind, my mind that is quite paranoid, It's not paranoid in the sense of conspiracy. I don't know why it doesn't touch conspiracy, but it's very persecutory. That same bridge thing, I wasn't asked one time, and I had made up a complete story as to why I wasn't going to be asked to partner with that lady. I make up very good stories, and I now can get to the place in which I can look at it. Well, I have to be aware, because it gets ahead of me. But then, just look at it, and even marvel at the creativity of it, and realize that in that story, I am, of course, victim, but I'm also persecutor, and I'm also rescuer. I mean, I'm all of them. I'm righteous, self-righteous. I'm splaying on the floor, you know. And so the thing is, I think that's valuable is just to take a distance, look at it, and sit with it. And then all of a sudden, it shifts. And I'm not there anymore. And the story loses its energy. And so that's one of my practices. The third practice that I mentioned today, and it's maybe the one that has been the hallmark the last 2 years, is gratitude, to practice gratitude. And my most significant guide right now is Pema Chodron. Here's this book, When Things Fall Apart. And it's a typical Buddhist way, only she's an American, and she was a Catholic, mother of a bunch of children. Her husband left her. She became a Buddhist, but she has our idioms. So if you read a Buddhist text by a Buddhist, it's hard for it to connect viscerally, but she has our idiom. And so one of her practices, she suggests, is gratefulness. And it somehow or the other has connected with me. And this morning, I get every day a little word of gratitude on my computer. You know how you can do that kind of thing. And somewhere here I have today's, well, I could find it later. It's maybe at the very, very bottom. It would be at the very, there's no transparency. It's just a sheet. And I thought, No. Okay, it was from Pema Chodron, and I thought that was that, because most of them on gratitude are from David Stendhal-Rock, because he has a whole bit on gratitude. But the idea of just sitting until I can experience gratitude for the day, for the moment, you know, whatever is being dealt up. And I mean, I have a pretty nice life, so for the most part, it's not hard to do that. But that's that. Yeah. So I just want to, Ani and I talked briefly, and she has a poem that came out of an important moment in her life.
It's an example of the "and" that that she was speaking of. I had it cued.
Isn't that wonderful?
I call it Mystical Moore. It's short. I was named after my uncle as Jackie. I was named after God as Ani. But who I really am has no name nor an identity. I'm more the "and" between Jackie and Ani, or the forward slash between their either or. I'm more the fulcrum of their balance, or their synergistic more. Jackie, Ani, synergistic more. Who would you like to see when you knock on my door?
Thank you, Jackie.
Yes.
would like to share.
I just wanted to mention that the way of looking at these pictures to try to see the three-dimensionality requires you to look through them rather than at them. Mm-hmm. And just to point out that this is a very old tradition in Orthodox iconography. When the Orthodox paint an icon, they say to you, pray through it, not to it. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what's going on here.
Uh-huh. How many of you did see something? And would you tell us about yours? Yes.
Well, I had a mentor over here who told me how to practice because I could only see all those roses. And I think part of it is quieting yourself down and not worrying about focusing, but just maybe breathing and letting the experience happen. But I saw the heart raised off the paper three or four or five times, and then I just let myself in and was trying to mentor someone else, and then I saw it depressed. Regressed, however you want to say it. So first it popped out at me, and then I saw it in absolutely the opposite direction. It was very exciting.
Yeah, what was some of the experience? How did you experientially? Could you share some of that when we talked?
Well, I guess the one word that I want to say was that I was sort of mystified that this experience was possible.
Uh-huh.
Because it seemed like such an ordinary but beautiful photograph. But it wasn't about seeing, it was about experiencing.
Mm.
Could we pass those around?
Yeah. Some are all around because I have 10 of them all together. I have to hold on to that one because it's my napkin. Anybody else who wants it, please don't just sit on them. So, other comments? Either of the two of you back. And I'll catch you after Keith. Okay.
Getting back to gratitude.
Yes.
I had a teacher in my life, among many, about 20 years ago, and I was struggling with gratitude. So he gave me an index card, and he said, "I want you to write three things today that happened today that you're grateful for." And then every night, before I went to bed, I had to call him up and read them.
How wonderful.
And in the beginning, I usually go to bed around 11 o'clock. 10 o'clock, he'd come and I'd be he used to kid me and say, "That's really hard, isn't it?" And, it's an experience, like most things that we're talking about. And eventually, I had three things on there by 10 o'clock in the morning. And then I had more than three things. And then I didn't need the card. Except when you remind me that I need to write them down again.
Because we also lack in any practice. And there's a wonderful Buddhist admonition. When you're asked to do one of their purest practices is to breathe without thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So you concentrate on the breath, and you go one, two, Johnny didn't turn in that thing. The rule is as soon as you discover you're thinking, you go back to one. So back to one is part of the practice. It isn't a punishment for being wrong. You're going to have the thinking mind come in. So back to one is sort of totally reimagined. In a book that I won't get to tell you about, but it's very interesting, called Open Brain Focus. Open Focus Brain. Open Focus Brain. Which is an attempt to get to that mystical, non-dualistic place. It's totally outside of religion, but it's very, very interesting. There goes the mind.
Going back to one.
Going back to one. Thank you. Thank you. He said that there was somebody who asked in using it to say do a game, because you know, like the same game of tennis, the inner game of tennis, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of, because what you want him to do is be in the flow, and then you're different in everything you do in the world. The person said, I want you to help me not to lose it. He said, oh no, what I'll help you is to find it again faster. Okay. So do you see here how that reconfigures totally the idea of getting off track? Getting off track is something you will do.
Mm-hmm.
It's, can you get back on without spending the next half hour lambasting yourself? Yes, John.
Don, I was just going to say, with the journey, this journey of freedom that comes from shaking off totally, just a, simply a dualistic approach, I'm grateful for the presence of this group and yourself in particular, and anyone who presents to us to be with us on the journey. And I think what's helpful to me is that Claudia, my wife, and I, and our friend Sharon, we travel together back and forth here, and then we talk, and Claudia and I talk a lot about, we're going through this together, but we're not alone.
Uh-huh.
Because aloneness is kind of scary, because the world doesn't speak to us about what we're talking about.
That's right.
Unless I begin to hear it or see it in the world.
Yes.
Yeah. But otherwise, it's anxiety causing and very kind of scary.
At Pacifica, because this conversation could have happened there. At Pacifica, a lot of our support had to be for the students going back to their world in which they were profoundly countercultural,
mm-hmm.
to their world, even if where they came from was wonderful.
Yeah.
But for the most part, this is not the milieu. I'm sorry, Keith, you had asked, do you remember what it was?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
I guess last few years really impressed me about the importance of the journey.
Yes.
So don't worry so much about getting there.
Yes.
Just this practice. And the example where it really struck me, I don't know if you remember on the Sunday morning news a few years ago, was about a fellow who had been blinded as a very small child before he was two,
uh-huh.
chemical accident. And when he was in his 40s, they developed a surgery that, before he had cornea transplants, but the body just rejected it. But this time it kept him, and after all these years he could see, and it took him almost 6 to 8 months to visually recognize his wife and children.
Mm-hmm.
By sound he could,
mm-hmm.
but the brain had never developed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how maybe in our spiritual brain, or whatever you want to call it, it takes a long time to develop all these things.
Yeah. Yeah, and one reason is that if sometime in the future the board or the other does anything on brain, I'd like to do. I'm very interested in the brain and the chemicals of the body. One of the books that I spend time with is Buddha's Brain.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks a lot about all the chemicals that's going through us when we are in meditation, as well as the changes in the brain. And it's amazing because it also supports us in the journey. But it's like in the story you're talking about, loads of brain cells have migrated from the job of seeing to hearing, and often people who are blind hear much more acutely. Well, they have twice as many cells working on it, you know, because the cells do not stay dormant. They find something to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so those have to then be in some way relocated back to this job of seeing. This will be,
You use the word diffuse.
Yes.
And I like that because so much of the meditative practices are focused. And that doesn't work for me.
I specifically, I for years I've been taking jazz piano through adult ed.
Uh-huh.
And the teacher is, she has both sides of her brain so beautifully developed.
Uh-huh.
Maybe Zanke. And she does a lot of gigs around town and so forth. But she says, you know, you really want to think about the chord, just exactly what notes are in it so you can voice it anywhere on the piano, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm better off dropping all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And becoming more diffuse.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Years ago, I was...
I don't know whether I'm right or wrong.
No, it's a time-honored, it's a time-honored methodology. And hopefully as we go through the rest of the speakers, I know you're doing work on art, maybe it would not be that kind of, you know, the iconic art, but I did a workshop, a week workshop with somebody called Linda South, and Barbara Rogers Gardner, who lived here in Santa Barbara, wrote a book on her. And what we did was we spent the whole time with a square in which the center of the square was a gold dot. A dot. And so, again, that was an invitation to very diffuse, yet in some ironic way focused, you know, but we're focusing on the dot. The ultimate of that, what you're talking about is what this guy does. And what he does is, I'll tell you what he does. We won't do it because of the time. He has you focus on something that isn't. So he has you start out by focusing on the space between your eyes. And just spend time with that. Focusing on the space between your eyes and your ears. You know, focusing on spacing your knee. Focusing on the space between your knee and the tip of your head. He goes on and on and on ad nauseum. Mm-hmm. That's one reason I find him, a repugnant. But it's very interesting, and I think the book has a CD in it that I've never listened to the CD because I can't imagine it. See, I can't imagine. But he says the quickest way to get to the state of diffusion, which is basically a synchronized alpha state, is through imagining something that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if we do it on the level of space, as opposed to imagining a unicorn, you know, because we can get back into narrow focus. Okay? So I do want to state right now, I'm going to pass up your one. And just, this is what I'm going to do, is read what I got this morning on my gratitude thing. It's wonderful. Wholeheartedness is a precious gift, but no one can actually give it to you. You have to find the path that's your heart. You can't have a wholehearted until you have a heart. You have to find the path that has heart and then walk it impeccably. It's like someone laughing in your ear, challenging you to figure out what to do when you don't know what to do. It humbles you. It opens your heart.
Thank you so much.